Regular program scheduled for this evening in order to bring you the following special report. From one end of the nation to the other and from overseas, ABC News will present live and continuous coverage of the developments surrounding today's presidential activities, with emphasis on how these events affect this nation.
Times Square is emptying out now, and New York's millions are heading home with extra editions of the daily papers detailing the crisis which has engulfed Richard Nixon and his presidency. The twilight calm of Chicago finds the residents moving toward the security of familiar gathering places. People seem to want to be together. They want to help one another try and understand what a resignation will mean and what lies ahead. Chicago, like much of the country, is trying to hurry through a day so that thoughts can be ready to receive the address by President Nixon, an address that will probably signal an end to a tumultuous 28 years in public office. I'm Harry Reisner.
I'm Howard K. Smith in Washington. Here in Washington, there's been a light rain for much of the day, and our mood has been rather like that, somber, expectably somber. Even our resident humorist, Art Buchwald, wrote an intentionally not funny column today. It was a kind of imaginary chat with dog checkers around the question of where did such a wonderful career go wrong. Democrats are not gloating. It could backfire if they displayed a mood like that, and Republicans have nothing to gloat about. But as Senator Aiken said yesterday in response to a question, if they thought on the Hill that Mr. Nixon were going to put a voluntary end to this situation, there would be relief on Capitol Hill. Well, they think so, and there is relief. At the White House, a meeting is going on. There are five members of Congress meeting with the president. The members of Congress are James Eastland, the president pro tem of the Senate, the man who's third in line for the presidency, a Democrat. Senator Mansfield of Montana, the leader of the Democrats in the Senate. Senator Hugh Scott, the leader of the Republicans in the Senate. And from the House, Carl Albert, second in line to the presidency, the Speaker of the House, and the leader of the Republicans in the House, John Rhodes of Arizona. ABC White House correspondent Tom Jarrell is there. Let's go to it. Tom?
Howard, the president is now meeting in his executive office building with the five members of Congress that you just referred to. We saw him climbing the steps going into his EOB office as we came to make this broadcast. The day here has been one which seems to be unreal. It is bizarre. It is very sad. The White House has tried to keep this from being a carnival atmosphere, but there have been major problems. They've succeeded in keeping news cameras off the lawns, but outside the lawns, crowds have stood around singing, chanting, many just standing and looking through the gates at the White House most of today. Inside, the unreal climate is compounded by the routine grinding out of news releases. There have been about 14 releases issued by the press office with presidential signatures on many of them, as though it were a routine day, appointment of judges and that sort of thing. The president, in one of his last, perhaps his last, congressional act, vetoed an agricultural appropriations bill. So,
why the Republic has troubles, television still has troubles. We've temporarily lost our line to Washington. Now we're going to go back to Washington. We're going to try it.
As I was saying, from the on the inside of the White House, much has been going on as it were a normal day, as if it were. There's been a turning out of news releases, appointment of judges, the veto of an agricultural appropriation bill. But of course, it is anything but normal. The faces are very sad. I've seen some of the veteran White House aides who I've seen travel with the president over these 6 years, their eyes red from having wept, others with tears in their eyes as they talk to newsmen. It has been a day where secretaries who have worked in the West Wing for the president in the White House, many have sat sort of stunned at their desk. Others have been weeping openly, others sort of laughing nervously, many unsure exactly what the future will be holding. They have been assured, the lower level White House assistants, that they have no need to worry for their future and for their jobs. The president we saw only briefly, and that was just a few moments ago. He was going from the Manchin section across West Executive Avenue and up the stairs into his EOB office. He was wearing a blue suit for television tonight. I believe he had on a blue shirt. He was walking very slowly with a Secret Service man some distance behind him. There are probably 30 to 40 stairs that he must climb as he goes into the EOB office. We've seen him climb those many times, and almost always he sort of springs up them very seldom using the handrail for much more than just guidance. But tonight he looked very tired. He walked very slowly as he climbed each step, very methodically moving up. He turned and he saw reporters, a few standing in the driveway looking over. They saw him. And he then looked out to the street where there was some chanting and singing of hymns going on. He didn't wave. He just looked rather sad and went on into his EOB office. ABC's Bill Zimmerman has been here, and he's been following the day's developments also.
For Gerald Ford, as for the president and everyone here at the White House, Tom, it has been anything but a normal day as well. Ford's day began very early. He left his home before or just after 7:30 this morning for the long drive into Washington, about a half hour. He met, of course, in a very presumably eventful meeting with the President of the United States for 70 minutes. He attended a Medal of Honor ceremony. He attended a long meeting, had Secretary of State Henry Kissinger in for perhaps an hour and a half, an hour and 40 minutes. He issued a statement shortly thereafter indicating very strongly what he has indicated very strongly previously, that he believes Secretary of State Kissinger has done a brilliant job in the foreign policy area, that he would like to have Secretary of State Kissinger stay on in the job, and that he has reason to believe Secretary of State Kissinger will stay on in a Ford administration. Ford's staff has been very difficult to get to today. They've been extremely busy, of course. First, they have postponed and then repostponed and finally canceled a scheduled 12-day trip to the West Coast and Hawaii, which was to begin today by the Vice President. They have had to call all of the people involved with that trip, have had to cancel out all of the engagements they had scheduled. They have been busily preparing for the transition, we're told, for about 2 days, and they've been busy. They have had no comment, and it seems slightly ironical that the Vice President, who is known as an open, accessible man, has been very hard to get to today. Now back to you, Howard.
Thank you, Bill. Tom Gerrell at the White House. This is clearly one of those formative days in American history. If the difficult situation is handled one way, it could bring tranquility to the nation and progress from our present situation. If it's handled in a different way, it could bring acrimony and division. That is to a great extent in the hands of the president and what he says tonight, but to some extent in our hands, and we're going to be very careful about it. Harry?
The president speaks to the nation at 9 o'clock, Washington time, New York time, Eastern Daylight Time, and while it is assumed that everyone knows he will announce his resignation, no one has a text, nobody but he knows what he is going to say. In the time remaining before Mr. Nixon speaks, we're going to visit a few of some two dozen locations at home and abroad where we have live cameras set up. We sample the anticipation and the puzzlement and the sorrow, and I suppose in some cases the optimism that variously grips people around the country and around the world. We're going to begin here in New York with ABC's Roger Grimsby.
Times Square may be the best known location in New York City, but it also approaches being the least representative. Nevertheless, the initial reaction here and elsewhere in New York City to the expected announcement of a Ford in the U.S. future has sponsored more condemnation than contemplation, more disdain than pain has been expressed. That is not to say there has not been an acceleration in the spate of resignation jokes. It is not unusual in times of crisis that the immediate reaction be sort of a silly season. There is evidence of that here in New York City. The reflection, the appreciation of the enormity of the moment, that comes later with a perspective that only time can bring. There is no wave of panic here in New York City, the counterclimb of Wall Street perhaps being the best evidence that important money feels resignation is best. In the last presidential election, New York City voters gave President Nixon a margin of 846,000 votes. Because 3 million votes were cast in the city, that cannot be construed as a landslide. But considering the history of New York voting, it certainly can be considered a major margin for President Nixon. Given time to reflect, no matter for whom you voted, this
is... Roger Grimsby in New York. Now we go back to Howard K. Smith in Washington.
Well, we're going to have some reports from many cities now, some of the cities I don't even know the names of. We're going first, though, to Capitol Hill, where ABC correspondent Sam Donaldson is waiting. Sam? Howard, Bob Clark and I, of course, have been on Capitol Hill all day. The mood of the House of Representatives is one of sadness and one of relief, in perhaps that order. There are no Democrats over there cheering tonight, at least I can't find any. This is a very sober occasion, and that's what the House thinks of it. But there is the feeling of relief that perhaps the trauma that's stopped business up here for so long is over, and the House and the country can move forward. Bob, I know that Republican caucus of senators ended just a few minutes ago. What was the mood there?
I'd have to say, Sam, that the mood was much the same. It was sad and solemn, but tinged with hope that the long ordeal of the Republican Party and the country is now over. Senator Javits came out and said he hoped that Jerry Ford, the new president, and everybody was being very careful to say that we don't know for certain yet that there will be a new president, but that Jerry Ford, if he is president, will be able to redeem Richard Nixon's pledge to bring the country together. And I think that's a strong hope here among all Republicans.
Yes, in the House, the emphasis when anyone talked about Ford, and of course that was every 30 seconds, was on his integrity, on his ability to bring the country together, and that he will project an image of honesty and one the country can rally around.
We have a little problem of how long the honeymoon will be, Sam, and I'm sure you're in the House. There'll be much the same situation. Jerry Ford is very close, and we should be saying Vice President Ford and getting used to saying Mr. President. But Mr. Ford is very close in political ideology to President Nixon. And the idea that somehow, and there's much talk around the Hill today, that everybody is going to rally around the new president and help him during these crucial days ahead, I don't think that honeymoon will last very long. We still have a great difference between the Nixon administration program, which will now become the Ford administration program, and the program of this Democratic-controlled Congress. And there are a lot of liberal Democrats who will be going at Mr. Ford very aggressively within a very few weeks.
That's true, Bob. Howard, if I may take just a moment to talk about this issue of immunity. We really haven't had a chance today to explore it very well. And that is the question of some understanding that Mr. Nixon, should he leave office, would not have to face any civil or potential criminal actions. It's the view of the House leadership, both Republican as well as Democratic, that Congress, one, probably doesn't have the power to grant a bill of immunity, and number two, it would not be appropriate for Congress to do so. And yet I want to stress that I detected nothing in that which meant that it was the wish of the leadership that the president should be prosecuted should he leave office. On the contrary, the wish of people that I've talked to in the House cloakrooms on both sides of the aisle has been that the country, if Mr. Nixon leaves office, should leave him alone. It's just that they don't want to formally try to do something in a legislative sense.
Well, Sam and Bob, you know, even if the government chooses to give the president immunity, they can only give him immunity from government suits. If a private citizen, a taxpayer, wants to sue the president for tax reasons, or indeed someone whose phone has been tapped wants to sue the president, as Henry Kissinger has been sued by one whose phone was tapped, the government can do nothing about that. Those are private citizens' suits. And so immunity would be very limited, even if the government wanted to give it.
That's very true, of course, Howard, but still I think a sense of Congress resolution that the president should not be prosecuted would carry very great weight with the special prosecutor, with the attorney general, with the new President Ford, who had to make those decisions. We had a difference of opinion between the Senate and the House today, quite interestingly, and Senator Edward Brooke, who, of course, was the first Republican senator to call for Mr. Nixon's resignation several months ago, today became the first to introduce a sense of Congress resolution that the president not be prosecuted. But then as he went on to explain that resolution, he made it very plain that he wants a full admission of guilt from the president before that resolution would take effect. And as we chatted with him at length this morning, he surprised me by saying that he would keep that resolution hanging, let it go to committee and hang in the Senate for months if necessary, even to the point of seeing what Mr. Nixon might have to say as a witness if he is called as a private citizen to testify at the still pending Watergate trials.
Bob and Sam, what about that? He's called to testify as witness number one at the trials of Ehrlichman and Haldeman and others. If the facts are what they seem to be, those men could be found guilty and could be sent to prison. Is it conceivable that the man they worked for and who gave the orders could go back to his office free while they who obeyed his orders could go to prison?
Well, that is the troublesome question. And that is why the House leaders and people in the House that I've talked to do not want Congress to attempt to pass any bill of immunity, leaving aside for the moment the question of whether Congress has the power. They do not want to say to the country, this man is above the law. Let me add carefully again that they see no reason to try to pursue him in the courts. And yet they don't want to have to say to the country, we are exempting him from the treatment that any other citizen would receive. Now, I think it just comes down to common sense, Howard. I think it comes down to the will of this country to not try to extract, if I may put it this way, the last pound of flesh. I detect in the House of Representatives, at least, no desire to do that. A desire that the country might be better served if Mr. Nixon chooses to step down. To allow him to do this in as much grace and dignity as can be mustered on both sides, to then try to let him alone while it puts its eyes forward on Gerald Ford and the business of the Republic. I hate to sound like a civics lecture, but that's really the way I think most people in the House of Representatives feel tonight.
But Howard, still another point that is going to be raised and raised very seriously in the Senate regarding immunity is that of amnesty for Vietnam veterans. Senator Hart of Michigan already raised it today, and he's prepared to take it to the floor. The idea, can we in good conscience as a nation refuse amnesty to not Vietnam veterans, but to persons who left the country and did not fight in the Vietnam War, and at the same time vote amnesty to a president who has confessed to what amounts to obstruction of justice. You're going to be hearing considerably more about that point from Senate liberals in the next few weeks.
Thank you very much. I think that indicates that we're not cutting a Gordian knot tonight. We're going to still have some loose ends that have to be tied up. It's going to be still a little complicated, though I think the main problem may, if all the rumors are true, be solved. Harry?
We'll be talking about the main problem and the subsidiary problems and how the country and the world feel about them in the time remaining before President Nixon tells us whether that main problem has found a resolution. And we'll continue that with Howard when our coverage of President Nixon's night continues after this message. ABC News and the country are awaiting the speech to the country by President Nixon at 9 o'clock New York and Washington time, a speech which is almost unanimously believed to contain his announcement of resignation. That means that at some point in the near future, we will have a new president, Gerald Ford of Michigan. For the first time in history, we will have a man as president who has never been elected to anything on a national vote. He's been elected for a long time, since 1948, I think, by two counties in Michigan to be a representative. But he was the first man to be appointed vice president under the 25th Amendment. And he will be the first man to succeed to the presidency upon resignation of a president rather than death. This is the kind of thing that is occupying the country and our attention tonight before the president actually speaks. Questions like, well, what happens to Richard Nixon if he does resign? They just heard a discussion of the various aspects of what immunity is possible to grant to him and whether it is the mood of the Congress and of the American nation that he should indeed have immunity. We'll be continuing to sample opinion to look at what the country is thinking, what the world is thinking, and at 9 o'clock New York time to see what Richard Nixon is thinking. Howard?
Sam Donaldson is on Capitol Hill, and he's talking with a Republican congressman who was one of the major swing voters in the House Judiciary Committee hearings and debate last week, Robert McClory of Illinois. Sam?
Howard, Mr. McClory was one of seven Republicans who joined to vote for an article of impeachment in the committee. What is your reaction tonight?
Well, I'm sure that the impeachment inquiry contributed to the president's resignation at this time, but I think that this is a very good solution. We're very grateful that he's seeing fit to resign instead of putting the country and the Congress through the ordeal of extensive debates in the House and a trial in the Senate. So I think, first of all, we should express gratitude that he's stepping down not only in his own interest, but in the national interest as well.
Mr. McClory, we were discussing a moment ago this question of immunity for Mr. Nixon should he step down. Immunity from further civil or potential criminal prosecution. What's your thought?
Well, I'm sure that we don't have any authority whatever to relieve him from any civil immunity. The subject of criminal immunity, of course, is one that is involved in the law, but I think it would be quite inappropriate for the Congress to either pass legislation or even to adopt a sense of the Congress resolution to express our desire for immunity. On the other hand, let me say that as far as I know, the members of the House, by and large, Republicans and Democrats, are not interested in pursuing Mr. Nixon beyond his resignation from office. I've talked to the Speaker of the House. I've talked with Mr. Rodino, the Chairman of the Judiciary Committee. They're not interested in pursuing him in any criminal proceedings. And I think that he can rest assured that following his resignation, he's really suffered the greatest penalty that a man can suffer, to step down from the highest office in the land to this sort of disgrace, which is bound to follow his resignation.
Mr. McClory, you have been much too busy recently, I'm sure, to give the matter much, if any, thought. But very soon, and within a matter of days or weeks, your committee is going to have to take on another major assignment, and that will be conducting hearings on the confirmations of whoever Mr. Ford, assuming he becomes president tomorrow, picks as a vice president. Have you given much thought to that?
Well, Bob, I haven't given a great deal of thought to that, but what you say is exactly right, and we'll probably have hearings, open hearings, televised hearings, as we did in the case of the confirmation hearings of Mr. Ford. So we'll be busy again with another assignment under the 25th article.
Well, let me ask who you would like to see Mr. Ford select as a vice president.
Well, I don't have any hesitancy in saying that I'm very much in favor of Nelson Rockefeller. He was a classmate of mine at Dartmouth College, a fraternity brother, and in my opinion, he would give great stature, great leadership to this administration, and would provide the kind of respect for government that is going to be, of course, characterized by Mr. Ford. But he could, in my opinion, assist Mr. Ford a great deal in foreign affairs and his knowledge of domestic issues as well. And Rockefeller would certainly be my man.
It was pretty well agreed at the time Mr. Ford underwent hearings both before the House Judiciary Committee and the Senate Rules Committee on his confirmation as vice president, that he underwent the most searching inquiry ever given any nominee by Congress, and that was including into his personal finances and taxes and so on. Would you expect that whoever the new vice presidential nominee is, that your committee would want to go into him just as thoroughly as it did Mr. Ford?
Well, I can attest to the thoroughness with which we investigated Mr. Ford. I would think that we'll make some changes. I think that the impeachment inquiry meetings and the televising of those sessions demonstrated a little higher level of service on the part of our House Judiciary Committee. And I would expect that in the confirmation hearings of Mr. Rockefeller, whoever it happens to be, who is named as vice president, will be a little more orderly, perhaps not quite as long drawn out, and I don't think we should get into matters of personal privacy to the extent that we did in Mr. Ford's case.
Thank you very much, Robert McClory, Republican of Illinois. Howard?
Well, one swallow doesn't make a summer, but two voices for Rockefeller may make a Rockefeller bandwagon, provided one is McClory's, who is a rather conservative Republican. Rockefeller has a reputation as being a rather liberal Republican. And the other voice is Ford's. Ford is a friend of Rockefeller's, has been pointedly friendly with him, and serves on Rockefeller's public questions panels. I think Virginia Sherwood is at the White House sampling the opinion of people there. Let's go to the White House and Virginia Sherwood.
Yes, Howard, I am here. I've been here all day. I've been watching the mood of the White House, and I've heard a lot from a lot of White House aides. But to put it in the words of Gerald Warren, he said, we're all holding in there. And he said, the big question, I guess, I went in his office and talked to him, is he said, everyone wants to know, was it worth it? And he said, to me, it was. It was worth it to all of us. And all of the girls and all the men who worked for him seemed to think it was worth it. As Tom Gerald's already told you, there were tears today. One girl, one press aide from the press office, went around taking pictures of all of her colleagues at their desk. And then she came to the press room and started taking pictures there, tears streaming down her face, as if perhaps they'd never be there again. Over in the East Wing, I'm told by people who've seen her very recently that Mrs. Nixon is holding up well, that she is the strength, but not quite the rock, because the rock, they tell me, is President Nixon himself. All day long, Gerald Warren told me he ran into the president this morning as he was coming to work. The president, coming out of his office, hit him on the shoulder and said, "Hi, Jerry," with a big grin. I'm told by other aides here that he has made himself have a big smile on his face whenever he saw any of his aides, building up all of the people here. Then I was told by one very close aide that he really is the rock. He is holding up the rest of the family. The girls are taking it very, very hard, Julie especially. I talked to someone who saw Julie yesterday. Julie has really broken down and really feels very badly about this, naturally, as do the rest of the family. Tricia, too, is taking it very hard. Of course, Mrs. Nixon, the hurt is there, as people who've talked to her have said. They can feel it, they can see it, but she's holding up for him. We have just found out, Howard, that the president will tell the nation tonight that he intends to resign, that he will fly to San Clemente tomorrow morning with part of his family, with Mrs. Nixon and part of his family. I'm not sure that all of them will be going, and he will be flying as president in Air Force One. Do you have any questions there, Howard?
Well, I just wonder, the two sons-in-law present, too, with the two daughters?
Give me the IFB.
Virginia, are the two sons-in-law present with daughters Julie and Tricia?
Howard, I'm sorry, I lost the IFB. Can you give me that?
Well, I was wondering if the whole families of the daughters are there. They're two husbands, Julie's husband, David, and Tricia's husband, Edward Cox.
Yes, the families did arrive here, and they have been here some time. The whole family had dinner together last night. As a matter of fact, it's reported here that the family tried very hard to talk the president out of this resignation speech tonight, but the president was firm. Also, I'm told by Jerry Warren that there have been 10,000 phone calls alone today urging the president to stay in there, not resign.
Well,
this is Virginia Sherwood from the White House.
Thank you very much, Virginia. Harry, we're going through a very dramatic day here in Washington. Do you got any reports on what people elsewhere think about this?
Well, it's reasonably dramatic too in New York, Howard. I think one of the interesting things which has been reflected in the comments from senators and congressmen that you've seen in Washington is that it's not a, even for the people who have not liked Richard Nixon for a long time and who were sorry to see him elected, it's not a day of joy for them. And probably the people who are most demanding vengeance and most reluctant to grant amnesty are not the long-time Nixon dislikers, but the people who supported him and who somehow feel cheated. And you think that's so? In other words, Senator Brooke, who was always lukewarm toward the president, says give him amnesty.
Yeah.
People who were his loyal friends say let the law take its course.
It was noticeable in the House Judiciary debate on impeachment that the one thing that really infuriated the conservative Republicans, was the second article, abuse of power. Opposed to big government, and when big government is abused, they are shocked, and conservatives have been shocked. Harry?
ABC News will be back with more coverage of this historic night following station identification. We are marking from as many and as good vantage points as we can a historic American night leading up to the time just an hour from now when President Richard Nixon is expected to announce that he will be the first American president to resign his office. This process that led up to tonight has been going on a long time, but it began to climax this week. When Mr. Nixon made his Watergate disclosures this Monday, it was once apparent that he was in much more trouble than he had been before. Members of the House and Senate, who had supported him through a lot of trouble, dropped their support and called for his resignation. The president stood fast, saying that although he knew his case was damaged and although he admitted responsibility for bad actions, he would let the constitutional process run its course. But by late yesterday, when three Republican leaders came to see him and then emerged from the White House saying that they had had a solemn conversation among four old friends, it was clear that the president's position was hopeless. Hugh Scott, the Republican leader of the Senate, told reporters that he had described to the president the gloomy outlook on Capitol Hill. And Senator Barry Goldwater reportedly told the president that he could count on no more than 15 to 20 senators to vote against conviction if he was impeached by the House. He knew that he would need at least 34 votes to prevent conviction and removal from office in an impeachment trial. Well, since that meeting ended last night, events have moved very quickly, and although officials continued for some time to report that the president had reached no decision on resignation, there were increasing signs that he had. As the lights in the White House press office burned late last night, word leaked out that speechwriters had been told to draft a resignation statement. There was a visit to the White House last night and again this morning by Secretary of State Kissinger, the man who would, under the law, had to accept a presidential resignation letter. When Kissinger left, the president spent some time with his family, and some aides report that his daughters tried to talk him into continue toughing it out. An indication at the very least the president understood the message from his House and Senate visitors and was seriously considering resignation as an option. By early this morning, the signs were even more visible. Vice President Gerald Ford's office announced that a trip to the West Coast and Hawaii, planned by the vice president, was being postponed. A short time later, Mr. Ford was summoned to the White House. He spent an hour and 10 minutes with the president. As they met in the Oval Office, a breathless White House aide, who refused to be identified, confirmed that Mr. Ford was being told of President Nixon's decision to resign and make Gerry Ford president. A few minutes after noon, the vice president left the White House. Newsmen were called to the press briefing room, and News Secretary Ronald Ziegler, one of the few aides who remained with Mr. Nixon since the beginning, announced that the president would address the nation tonight at 9 o'clock Washington time. He said further the president would meet with congressional leaders early this evening. It wasn't long this afternoon before word came out of Capitol Hill that Gerald Ford would be sworn in on as president probably tomorrow. So it appears that in slightly less than an hour from now, Mr. Nixon will announce his plans to resign as the 37th president of the United States. And tomorrow, with part of his family, he will make the flight to California on an Air Force plane, but maybe not Air Force One. Howard?
Harry, you were talking about the blows the president has been receiving lately. There have been three especially. One was that Supreme Court ruling that he would have to hand over the tapes that Mr. Jaworski had subpoenaed. Two, the House Judiciary Committee's votes on three articles of impeachment. But in a way, the biggest blow was the release on Monday by the president of the tape transcripts of his conversations from shortly before the Watergate break-in, shortly after the Watergate break-in. ABC's Frank Reynolds has some details.
Although it is true that Watergate has been with us a long time, more than 2 years now, the rush to the end really has been terribly swift. Even up until this week, before the president released those three latest transcripts, there was considerable hope on the part of his supporters, members of the Judiciary Committee who did not vote for impeachment, that somehow he would be able to survive a trial in the Senate, and there was every indication that he intended to go ahead with it. However, on Monday of this week, April or August 5th, the president released the transcripts of those three conversations with H.R. Haldeman, conversations that were important not merely because of what was said, but because of when it was said. On June 23rd, 1972, just 6 days after the break-in, and putting in great question the president's repeated assertions that he knew nothing really of the cover-up of Watergate until March 21st of the following year. On Monday, when the president released those transcripts, he said in this statement, and I'm going to read part of it, "On April 29th, in announcing my decision to make public the original set of White House transcripts, I stated, as far as what the president personally knew and did with regard to Watergate and the cover-up is concerned, these materials, together with those already made available, will tell it all. Shortly after that, in May, I made a preliminary review of some of the 64 taped conversations subpoenaed by the special prosecutor. Among the conversations I listened to at that time were two of those of June 23rd. Although I recognized that these presented potential problems, I did not inform my staff or my counsel of it, or those arguing my case, nor did I amend my submission to the Judiciary Committee in order to include and reflect it. At the time, I did not realize the extent of the implications which these conversations might now appear to have. As a result, those arguing my case, as well as those passing judgment on the case, did so with information that was incomplete and in some respects erroneous. This was a serious act of omission for which I take full responsibility and which I deeply regret." Well, what were those conversations that, when they finally were released, caused this sudden, dramatic turnaround in the support for the president, caused members of the Judiciary Committee who had supported him, Mr. Wiggins of California, Hutchinson of Michigan, to announce that they were now prepared to vote for impeachment? Haldeman and the president were talking that day in the Oval Office of the White House. June 23rd, 1972, Haldeman had just reported to the president that Mitchell and John Dean had come up with recommendations to solve this Democratic break-in thing, is the way Haldeman put it. And I'll pick up to read just some of these conversations. Haldeman says that the way to handle this now is for us to have Walters of the CIA, call Pat Gray of the FBI, and just say, "Stay the hell out of this. This is business here. We don't want you to go any further on it. That's not an unusual development, and that would take care of it. The president then said, what about Pat Gray? You mean Pat Gray doesn't want to? And Haldeman says, Pat does want to. He doesn't know how to. And he doesn't have any basis for doing it. Given this, the CIA ploy, he will then have the basis. He'll call Mark Felt in, and the two of them, and Mark Felt wants to cooperate because he's ambitious. Mark Felt was with the FBI. The president says, yeah. Haldeman goes on, he'll call him in and say, we've got the signal from across the river to put the hold on this. And that will fit rather well because the FBI agents who are working the case at this point feel that's what it is. Then the president says, this is CIA, they've traced the money, who'd they trace it to? Haldeman says, well, they've traced it to a name, but they haven't gotten to the guy yet. The president says, would it be somebody here? Haldeman replies, Ken Dahlberg. The president says, who the hell is Ken Dahlberg? Haldeman replies, he gave $25,000 in Minnesota, and the check went directly to this guy, Barker. The president says, it wasn't from the committee, though, from Stans. Haldeman says, yeah, it is. It's directly traceable, and there's some more through some Texas people that went to the Mexican bank, which can also be traced to the Mexican bank. They'll get their names today. And the president says, well, I mean, there's no way. I'm just thinking, if they don't cooperate, what do they say? That they were approached by the Cubans. That's what Dahlberg has to say. The Texans, too, that they... Haldeman interrupted to say, well, if they will. But then we're relying on more and more people all the time. That's the problem. And they'll stop if we could take this other route. The president's response was, all right. And then this passage. Haldeman said to the president, and you seem to think the thing to do is to get them to stop. The president says, right, fine. Haldeman, they say the only way to do that is from White House instructions, and it's got to be to Helms and to, what's his name, Walters, the president, Walters. Haldeman says, and the proposal would be that Ehrlichman and I call them in and say, the president, all right, fine. How do you call him in? I mean, you just, well, we protected Helms from one hell of a lot of things. Haldeman says, that's what Ehrlichman says. The president then makes this statement. Of course, this hunt, that will uncover a lot of things. You open that scab, there's a hell of a lot of things, and we just feel that it would be very detrimental to have this thing go any further. This involves those Cubans, Hunt, and a lot of hanky-panky that we have nothing to do with ourselves. Then the president said, well, what the hell did Mitchell know about this? Haldeman replied, I think so. I don't think he knew the details, but I think he knew. Later on, in that same conversation on June 23rd, and keep in mind this was just 6 days after the break-in at the Watergate, the president seems to be giving Haldeman a sort of scenario or instructions on how to handle this thing with the CIA, and he says, when you get in unintelligible people, say, look, the problem is that this will open the whole Bay of Pigs thing, and the president just feels that without going into the details, don't lie to them, to the extent to say there is no involvement, but just say this is a comedy of errors without getting into it. The president believes that it is going to open the whole Bay of Pigs thing up again. And because these people are plugging for unintelligible, and that they should call the FBI in and unintelligible, don't go any further into this case, period. And I suspect it was that conversation. And the two others, of course, that were also released on that day, that caused so many members of the Judiciary Committee, members of the Senate, to change their mind, to announce that, in the words of Edward Hutchinson, perhaps the president's staunchest, though most silent defender on the Judiciary Committee, that he felt he had been deceived. And that led, of course, eventually to the meeting at the White House last night with the Republican leaders, where the president was told that there was no chance that he could escape conviction in the Senate. And now, within the hour, we'll learn his official response. Howard?
Thank you, Frank. One of the impressive things to me has been the consistency with which the president in his statements about Watergate over the past year and a half has seemed to underestimate the seriousness with which other people took what was happening. He always seemed to be just several stages behind public opinion on them. I remember when he was running for the presidency, I did some commentaries, and he used occasionally to listen. I did some saying I didn't care who won the election, but I hope no one would win by a landslide, because landslide presidents always became overconfident and made mistakes. And I cited Harding and Franklin D. Roosevelt in the court packing scheme and President Johnson in Vietnam. And after the election in January, President Nixon invited me to the White House and said, I listened to your comments about worrying about a landslide president. Well, you don't have to worry about this president. I'm going to be very careful. Well, that was about 3 months before the roof fell in. And the president never seemed to catch up with the seriousness that other people attributed to the affair. Harry?
I remember very well when you made that remark about landslides, Howard, and I remember that I chuckled, and I have promised since that I will never chuckle again when you say something at the end of an election night. Two interesting figures from Richard Nixon's career are Herb Klein, about whom he said some uncomplimentary things in the transcripts he released last Monday, but who had been a close associate of his for many years, and Pat Brown Sr., the former governor of California who beat Richard Nixon in 1962 for that office and led to the famous time when Richard Nixon retired from political life and said that the press would not have him to kick around anymore. They are both in Los Angeles at the moment with Christine Lund of KABC-TV.
Hey, thank you, Harry. We are here in Los Angeles. We're going to be talking with the former director of communications for President Nixon, Herb Klein, and former California Governor Pat Brown, who is the only American alive who ever defeated Richard Nixon for public office. And that bitter defeat in 1962 in the race for governor did prompt that bitter statement, you won't have Dick Nixon to kick around anymore. And that campaign that you were the object of 12 years ago had a great deal in common with Watergate and Watergate dirty tricks. Even some of the names were the same, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Chapin. And if Watergate has evolved, have you thought about the similarities?
Well, I don't think the 62 campaign had any of the dirty tricks that we saw in the Watergate situation at all. There was a two or three things that I didn't like at all during the campaign, but on the whole, it was rather a clean campaign, I thought. But when Richard Nixon made that infamous or famous statement that he'd been treated unfairly by the press and said that you won't be able to kick Dick Nixon around anymore, from there on out, I always doubted his capacity to hold any public office. It worried me. Not as a person, but as a leader.
Do you have any thoughts right now? It seems almost inevitable that we are in the last hours of the Nixon administration. What are your thoughts about the man?
Well, I think it's a tragedy. I feel particularly sorry for his family. I think that he's doing the only thing that he can do. I think the country's been rudderless for a long period of time as a result of these attacks that have been made. And I think I haven't heard, of course, what he's going to say, but I feel very definitely that this is the only course he can follow.
Mr. Klein, the credibility of a new secretary, and of course the administration that they represent, depends so much on how honest that new secretary can be. You serve two masters, the president and the public interest, which usually means telling the truth, and that's not happened with Ron Ziegler. He's either misled or lied outright to the public, trying to minimize Watergate. He's called it a two-bit burglary. The list is long. How do you feel, really, yourself, about the way the president views the new secretary?
I think Ron Ziegler's been put in an unfortunate position, and principally by some of the people who are on the White House staff, John Dean, for one, who fed him some...
What I really mean is the president's own motivation, how he himself decided to use Ron Ziegler, who is an employee, actually a passive human being.
I think it put Ron Ziegler in a position in which he couldn't recover, and so he's had growing difficulty with the press. On the other side, I think that the press has become highly emotional in recent weeks and months, partly because of frustration with the briefings, partly because they felt they hadn't seen enough of the president, and so you've had a very tense situation, which has not produced the kind of news that you like.
But it seems an almost inescapable truth now, especially in the light of the president's own admissions this Monday, that he himself, President Nixon, made deliberate decisions to use the new secretary this way. What do you think about that? You've worked for the president.
I think that the answer always has to be frank and honest. I think that one of the things we went in was with a major effort to be credible and to be honest. And I have to say I made every effort I could to do that. I think the fact is that had the truth been told right after the break-in occurred, you wouldn't have the very tragic situation today, which leaves me with a great deal of pain, and I know it must give the president a great deal of pain.
Mm-hmm. What the president is probably going to have to say to the nation in a short time from now, most people have guessed and probably guessed accurately about it. It must be most painful for men like you who have been one of his most staunch defenders. How do you feel right now about the man and the politicians?
I feel very, very bad. I feel torn up inside. I've been talking to Bob Finch, who's another person who feels as I do, and he feels the same way. We're both look at it that here was a man who had accomplished great things, and I think history will mark that, and who's brought down by some things which basically were probably not within his knowledge at all. I don't believe he knew anything about the break-in. And suddenly, a little thing snowballed into a big thing, and it's brought a very tragic end to a great career.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Brown. Thank you, Mr. Klein. Christine Lund from Los Angeles. Back to you, Harry.
Two very interesting men from Richard Nixon's past career, Pat Brown, who beat him for governor of California in 1962, and Herb Klein. It's sometimes been said of Mr. Nixon that he doesn't have very many close friends and he has trouble inspiring close personal loyalty, but Herb Klein and Robert Finch, whom he mentioned, are two exceptions. They have been loyal to Richard Nixon for a long time and are now. Mr. Klein, who knew him first when Nixon was a congressman running for Congress, and Klein was a young reporter, stuck with him all through the years and remains loyal, even though, as we noted in the transcripts released last Monday, Mr. Nixon was quoted as saying some rather uncomplimentary things about whether Herb Klein had his head screwed on right or not. Howard?
Seeing Governor Brown reminds one of a very remarkable fact about Richard Nixon's political career. He was a perfect politician almost, yet he was very limited as a campaigner. He very often began his campaigns the top dog by a long way in the opinion polls and then gradually lost. He was way ahead of Kennedy in 1960. I think he was 8 to 10 percentage points ahead and came down to where he lost. He was 10 percentage points or more ahead of Humphrey in 1968 and came down to where they were almost even. He was ahead of Governor Brown early in their campaign for the governorship in 62 and was finally defeated by the governor. It's one of the remarkable facts. Well, I understand something is happening now at the Executive Mansion, which Theodore Roosevelt made legally named the White House, and Steve Bell is there. Steve?
Howard, it's not that we have any major event that's transpiring at the moment. We simply are learning a little more of how the events are to take place here. As you've already been told, the president does plan to leave late tomorrow morning for San Clemente. We've learned now that before that, there will be a farewell meeting of sorts with the intimate staff members. It will be held in the White House complex. Other details are not known at this time. We've also learned that traveling with the President and Mrs. Nixon and members of the family will be many of his personal aides, those who have been closest to him, not necessarily those in policy positions, along with Ronald Ziegler, who's expected to go, Manolo Sanchez, his personal valet, Steve Bull, who's been a personal aide for 5 years, the kind of man who pitches in and does whatever is necessary, Jack Brennan, another staff member. Among those staying behind will be Rosemary Wood, his secretary, and she will be more or less in charge of the packing up that will still have to be done after the president leaves here tomorrow. We had a chance to talk for a while this evening with Steve Bull, who has really had a more intimate relationship with the president than many of the far better known members of the administration and close advisors. Steve Bull isn't the kind of man who gets into policy discussions with the president, but he has some very firm opinions about the man he has worked for and hopes to continue to work for. Steve said tonight that he would have to accept this definition that's been used the last few days of the president as a man who has reached a state of serenity, who has a serene appearance and outlook. Steve Bull attributes that to courage. He says the president is the most courageous man he has known. And especially, he says, once the president has made a decision, that's when you begin to see this serenity. He said that he and other intimate staff members held out hope until today that the president would stay on, but now all the tasks he has are pointed toward transition.
Steve, it's remarkable that two people, two members of the cabinet, have called the president serene in the past 2 days, Kissinger today and Simon of the Treasury yesterday. I think the president must have had his personal crisis back in January when that 18-and-a-half-minute gap was discovered. We noticed then he was pale and haggard. His movements and speeches were, his gestures were rather awkward, and he seemed to be undergoing a personal crisis, which apparently he's now learned to live with and has achieved the serenity you're talking about. Harry?
I noticed that Secretary Kissinger not only said it was serenity, he said he was in a philosophical mood, which I suppose is what you need if you're facing what Richard Nixon faces tonight. We and the rest of America are assembling around our television sets awaiting President Nixon's talk at 9 p.m. We've got a couple of very interesting people, which we will have when ABC News resumes its coverage of this historic night after this message. Out in Chicago, we've got a couple of people that ought to be very appropriate to talk to on this night, just before President Nixon makes in his historic address. One of them is Studs Terkel, a unique American figure, a radio broadcaster, a reporter, a man who's done a couple of books about mass America, lower-level America, the kind of America that lives east or west of Division Street, I forget which it is in Chicago. And Clayton Kirkpatrick, the editor of the Chicago Tribune and an outstanding journalist, and a man connected with a paper which for a long time supported Richard Nixon and reluctantly decided to stop supporting him not long ago. They're with Faye Flynn of WLS-TV. Faye?
My guests are Clayton Kirkpatrick, editor of the prestigious Chicago Tribune, and Mr. Studs Terkel, television veteran, best-selling author, and taker of the public pulse. Mr. Kirkpatrick, when you and your newspaper took the decision you did on May the 9th in your editorial, asking for the resignation of President Nixon, did you anticipate this development?
Well, we certainly didn't anticipate it, although we, I suppose, hoped for it. We did believe at that time that the president should leave office at the earliest possible moment for the welfare of the country. And it did take a long time. I think that now the country is pretty well satisfied that that position was a sound position.
How important do you think your stance at the Chicago Tribune was in bringing about this ultimate development?
Well, it created a considerable wave across the country. It was the talk of Washington for a few days. I know that it had a great effect on a great many political leaders. It did have a great effect on our own readership, too, and the reactions were, in some cases, violent.
Studs Terkel has had great success with a tape recorder, interestingly enough, in coming up with his hard times and working. What kind of a reading do you get in the Midwest with what's happening?
I find irony perhaps the astonishing aspect of it. Clayton Kirkpatrick, who's very courageous, by the way, I think indicates to me that there's a possibility of people growing and changing with times and the world in which we live. I find that technology is so important. President Nixon, I use the same tape recorder. You were 4,000, but used for two different purposes. I don't know what the lesson is to be learned. I think mostly that people themselves in an open society must always question authority, no matter who or what that authority might be. And for several years now, we've heard the phrase silent majority, though little heard these days. Silent majority is an obscene phrase in open society. One must always question and dissent. I think this is what Sam Adams and Tom Paine had in mind. Rather, the lesson Watergate is that. Henry Steele Commager said it, our distinguished historian. Dissent in open society is not merely a right, it's a duty as well. I think that perhaps is the key lesson of Watergate.
Now that we're at this point, Mr. Kirkpatrick, what's your editorial stance?
Well, I think that we're going to take a balanced position. We're going to say that we welcome Jerry Ford as the new president. We have confidence in him. We believe that the country can take a renewed impetus to progress now. We've cleared away an obstacle which has haunted us for a long time. We are not going to be vindictive about the president, that is President Nixon. We are going to say that he did some good things. We want to give him credit for that. We don't want his blood, but we think it is very beneficial for the country that we do have Mr. Ford as his successor.
What do you think the long-term reaction might be, Studs?
I hope it is the issue more than Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford. Simply the man on the street, so-called, that phrase, all of us being aware of what is going on and demanding more awareness. And that's simply to say the man up there is more worthy than I, because if I were as worthy as he, I'd be up there. No, that each of us has a right to speak out. To me, this is the key to everything.
Do either of you expect any serious reaction to this development, or is this anticlimactic?
I think it's anticlimactic. I think that people were under severe tension and uncertainty until this happened. And tonight, I think they're waiting with curiosity more than anything else.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Studs Terkel, Clayton Kirkpatrick. Now back to Harry Reisner.
That's a fascinating sight out there. I don't suppose there's been a time in my lifetime, Howard, that the editor of the Chicago Tribune comes on after having advocated the resignation or impeachment of a Republican president and taking, in a way, a somewhat more stronger stance editorially than the New York Times has taken. Robert McCormick, the man who made the Chicago Tribune what he called the world's greatest newspaper, were alive today, I don't suppose he could believe what he reads in the editorial pages.
If he were alive today, he would turn over in his grave, as they say.
Right. Okay. Well, we are all assembling for President Nixon's historic speech at 9 o'clock, and ABC News will be back with more coverage of this evening after station identification.
This is ABC.
President Nixon is going to address the nation and presumably announce his resignation in a half an hour from now. In the meantime, we are testing the sentiment around the country and with people particularly concerned with the events of the last 2 years and with the events of the next few weeks. Howard?
Yeah. We have former Senator Charles Goodell of New York here with us now. Senator Goodell ran for the Senate in the last election in New York State, and without Republican support, this Republican was defeated. Senator Goodell, what do you think about what's happening tonight? Do you think that the wise course is resignation or to go through the impeachment and trial course?
I think the wise course is resignation. I opposed resignation earlier because I felt that it was important that enough of this evidence be spread on the record, whatever evidence there was, so the American people would know what the situation was. I think that has now taken place in the House, and trial in the Senate would be a major ordeal, and it appears from the defection of those who were most ardently supporting and trying to defend the president that it's a foregone conclusion in the Senate. I think there is, the whole situation is fraught with tragic ironies, but the thing that strikes me tonight is that 6 years ago, I believe this very night, I was in Miami at the convention the night. Ordeal, and it appears from the defection of those who were most ardently supporting and trying to defend the president that it's a foregone conclusion in the Senate. I think there is, the whole situation is fraught with tragic ironies, but the thing that strikes me tonight is that 6 years ago, I believe this very night, I was in Miami at the convention the night that Richard Nixon was nominated by the Republicans, and none of us thought we'd be coming to this tonight.
What do you think the effect of this thing which we expect tonight will be on the Republican Party? Will it strengthen it, or will it be a thing?
I don't think there's any question that it will strengthen the party, certainly for the elections this fall. I don't anticipate that the Republicans will be able to turn it around and perhaps gain seats, net seats in the House or the Senate. But I do think it will stem the losses that were anticipated, that all the polls show are running right now in the marginal districts. I think we stood to lose a great many seats. Of course, it depends also on how Mr. Ford performs in office. But assuming he takes over and gives the people a new sense of direction and integrity in office, which I anticipate he will.
Senator Goodell, can you hear me?
I can hear you barely, yes.
You were one of the first and most dramatic casualties of the kind of split that the Republicans went through, that both parties went through because of the Vietnam War, and you stuck with it. Are most Republicans ready to come back now with Mr. Nixon gone, those who were injured by the kind of thing that happened since 1968?
Well, I don't expect John Lindsay to come back and a few of that nature, but yes, I think the Republicans out in the hustings are ready to come back. I think they will be inspired with confidence in Jerry Ford. A great many of them have been already. He not only brings a sense of integrity, I think some of the evidences are not clear yet to the people as just how strong a man he is and how intelligent a man he is and how prepared he is with his background and experience to take over at this very difficult moment.
Senator, the first thing that a President Ford would have to do is to choose a vice president to be put up to the Senate for confirmation. Whom would you suggest?
Well, I don't have any suggestions.
You're about alone in that.
Oh, I'll make some suggestions along the line, but I think what Jerry will do is consult as many people as he can. He will listen to the people for whom he has great respect. And I don't think he's going to make a hasty decision. It'll be one of his early ones. Obviously, he won't want to leave this position vacant for any longer than necessary. But on the other hand, I think the list that is fairly large now of those that might be considered is going to grow substantially in the days ahead. And then he'll start trimming it down and make his decision. I really don't think at this point he even has a concept of the major standards he would apply, whether he's going to try to balance, whether he's going to get into regional balances. I would think mainly he's going to choose the man that he wants in that office, regardless of his origins regionally. And I think he will choose a man that he thinks will have the support of the country as a whole.
A couple names out on you. What about your fellow New Yorker, Nelson Rockefeller?
He certainly will be on the list and given serious consideration. I don't think there are any front runners at this point with Jerry, because it's in a very, very preliminary stage of consideration. And I don't think Jerry is going to be thinking about 1980 when he chooses somebody. I think it really is a question of choosing somebody that he feels would be capable of stepping in, and there are going to be difficult times ahead of us. And I would expect he is going to be calling on the American people for some sacrifices very soon in the future.
Well, thank you very much, Senator Goodell. We go back now to Harry Reasoner, New York.
25 minutes now until President Nixon addresses the nation. Out in Chicago, it's 7:35, and out there is Joel Daly of WLS-TV. What is Chicago doing, Joel?
Chicago, Cook County, Illinois, as you know, is where Mayor Richard J. Daley controls the last of the big city political machine. It was here, according to the Nixon partisans, that the election was stolen from him in 1960. It was here again in 1968, 1972, where candidate Richard Nixon failed to overcome the vote-gathering efficiency of the Daley machine. And yet Chicago, by his own admission, is one of the president's favorite cities. He visited here regularly and was always welcomed with a respectful enthusiasm. Indeed, Mayor Daley was a comforting and vocal supporter of Mr. Nixon's stand on Vietnam. As a leader in the Democratic Party, he refused to criticize the president's handling of the Watergate affair, and during Mr. Nixon's last public appearance here in Chicago, stood next to him on the platform, exchanging compliments on national television. Chicago is the home of W. Clement Stone, the president's chief and most generous political contributor. And as you heard a short time ago, it is the home of the Chicago Tribune, where the best-known so-called Republican paper originally called for him to step aside, either by resignation or impeachment. Chicago is, in the words of Norman Mailer, the last of the great American cities where there is still a feeling of community, a sense of belonging, an ethnic and geographical melting pot, if you will. And from the people here in Chicago, I detect a generally positive reaction to the president's anticipated resignation. A kind of sigh of relief that this agonizing period of uncertainty is almost over. There is no apparent shock, no surprise. Most Chicagoans accept the departure of Richard Nixon now as a fait accompli, inevitable. A college student who has been backpacking around the country the past 6 weeks grinned when I asked him what he thought about the expected resignation. You know, he said, I've been to 35 states in Canada, and I've been able to pick an argument with anyone concerning Mr. Nixon. Even the older people, as he put it, who voted for Mr. Nixon now feel he is no longer a viable chief executive. If there were any visible concern in Chicago today, it centered on Vice President Ford, a resident of our neighboring Michigan. No one here seems to know much about Mr. Ford, and no one here is sure what kind of a president he'll be. I walked through Chicago's Loop earlier today, and I talked to the newspaper vendors. All agreed that sales were up, but disagreed as to why. Some insisted it was because of the headlines, Nixon to quit. Others claim that Chicagoans are more interested in the list of lottery numbers, the first to be drawn in our state's new lottery. And perhaps that best sums up the sentiment here in Chicago and the heartland. People are looking forward to tomorrow, many of them fully expecting that their luck may be changing. I'm Joel Daly, WLS-TV in Chicago.
According to the White House transcripts, during a some occasions when they were discussing administration programs in the Nixon administration, John Ehrlichman used to say, well, I wonder how that will play in Peoria. And Peoria has always been a name in American culture that got that kind of remark. We're going to find out how it's playing in Peoria from Chris Blatchford of WRAU.
Peoria is a strong Republican area and has also been a stronghold for Nixon's support. Peoria, in the minds of many, has become the stereotype for middle America, and generally speaking, Nixon has always sold here very well. Peoria's congressman for 8 terms, Robert Michael, has proudly associated himself with Nixon and his policies in the past, and it has never hurt him politically. Congressman Tom Railsback, who also has a number of constituents in the Peoria area, and voted for 3 articles of impeachment before the House Judiciary Committee, told us recently he has received great pressure from Peoria area GOP leaders not to vote for impeachment, another indication of pro-Nixon feelings here. President Nixon himself has visited Peoria in 1951, 60, 64, 68, and more recently in June of 1973. The trip last summer at a time when Watergate scandals were really starting to boil. No one would have ever known it had they witnessed the enthusiastic welcome President Nixon received here that June afternoon. Thousands lined the streets to cheer on their president and let him know they believed support for the president seemed to dwindle. Although there were still signs of strong pro-Nixon sentiments, the Peoria Journal-Star editorially supporting the president right up to the apparent end. But tonight, it seems to be a different story. In this area that once would probably have followed the president into a fire, our cameras on the streets today could only find several people who still have something good to say about their one-time favorite. In summation, I believe it would be fair to say that President Nixon tonight is just not playing anymore in Peoria. Chris Blatchford for ABC News.
I suppose that's indicative of something that's happened in this country in the last couple of decades. There isn't that much difference anymore between Peoria and New York. We're a more homogeneous country in terms of opinion and attitude and wealth than we used to be, for good or evil. We used to go from Peoria to New York, and that's what we're going to do. Roger Grimsby, reporting on the mood in New York.
Taking a public opinion poll here in Times Square with this relatively small sample is hardly an accurate pulse-taking of what people are thinking in New York, but perhaps it will give us some indication of how people feel. What is your opinion about the expected resignation of President Nixon?
I think he should have resigned a long time ago instead of making believe that he didn't have any reason to resign.
What do you say, sir?
I agree with him. That's all I have to say. I feel sorry for him, but he was one of the best presidents of the United States, I think.
Do you have an opinion?
Yeah, I don't think he should resign. I think he should be brought to the courts and, pay for what he did. This way, they want to give him immunity and everything else, and I don't think that's right, because he's being thrown out for, being false to the public. And if he resigns and they give him immunity, he's getting away with the whole thing.
There's one gentleman here I noticed in the crowd who I think may not be a New Yorker. Sir, do you have an opinion about the impending or expected resignation of the president?
Whatever, I believe that it would be better for him, and he would think for him that he will resign, as per my opinion, because of public opinion, and he's confused, you know, there is no any way for him to come out from it. That's why I think that he will resign.
Well, what is your opinion about, is it best for the world, is it best for the United States that he resign?
No, I think that's for United States.
It is better.
Yeah.
Miss, do you have an opinion about this?
The only opinion I really have is that I hope he just gets out of office fast, and I'd like to see Kennedy as our next president.
Those the opinions of some of the people gathered here this night in Times Square. I can say there's not a holiday attitude. I can also say that the sample was small. So it would be presumptuous to call this an accurate pulse-taking in New York City, but it might be indicative. At Times Square in New York City, I'm Roger Grimsby.
There's some feeling that Times Square is never representative of anything but Times Square, but I suppose that's true of whatever they call the Times Square in Peoria, too. Howard?
Well, Harry, we have someone who is representative of something. We have Congressman John Brademas, the deputy whip of the Democratic Party in the House of Representatives, and we have videotaped Sam Donaldson and Bob Clark interviewed him just a moment ago. Here they are.
John Brademas, a member of the House Democratic leadership from Indiana. Mr. Brademas, assuming the president is going to resign in a few minutes, what tone do you hope that you will find in that speech?
Well, I hope the tone of the president's remarks will be healing in nature, will not be divisive. I hope that the president not pretend that he is being driven from media and by partisans in Congress and in the country. I hope rather that the president will give some indication that indeed he has committed offenses of a grave kind that put him in the predicament in which he finds himself. The president does fails to make this kind of a reconciling speech, I think he will be laying a terrible burden on the back of his successor, Mr. Ford.
And Congressman, I've heard a good deal of perhaps on Capitol Hill today about rallying around the new president, supporting him, period. Yet, as you well know, having been on opposite sides of the fence with Mr. Ford on many, many issues over the years in the House, there is probably no more authentic Nixon Republican in Washington than Jerry Ford. How long is the honeymoon going to last?
Well, I would suppose it will last at least for a few months, and I hope it will, but I think that it in large part will depend on what Mr. Ford wants from that honeymoon. If Mr. Ford expects that Congress will sit supinely by and nullify viewpoints with which we may disagree, I think that on the other hand, we are looking forward to working with Mr. Ford, should he become the regard him as one of us. We regard him as a man who has the Constitution in his bones, in that he has a great respect for the role of the Congress in our three-department kind of government. And so I think that the outlook could be encouraging and constructive, in large part depending on how Mr. Ford would want to work.
Would you expect Mr. Ford to be any more liberal as president than he was in the House? And I'm thinking of the many issues you fought, aid to education, all of those crusading liberal causes. Do you see a new Jerry Ford in the White House?
I like to think so. And indeed, if I were to gamble, I would say the answer to that question would be yes, because he's no longer going to be the representative in Congress of a half a million people in his Michigan district, or indeed number two in a national administration. But now he's going to be number one. He's going to be the president of states. And I hope that that new responsibility will have the effect of broadening his own viewpoints, in part because he must be aware that there are many people out in the country who have been appalled, both Republicans and Democrats, by the offenses of which he has been a strong supporter. So I think he ought to bend over backwards, and I hope he will, to be president.
Democratic Congressman John Brademas talking about a possible Ford administration. Recently, the Republican Wednesday Club of House members of the Republican Party had a breakfast, and they invited me to come and talk to him about the press. And Gerald Ford was there, and when it was over, Ford said to me, "What do you think about impeachment?" Well, I was stunned. I said, "You're not supposed to ask me that. I'm supposed to ask you." But he insisted on an answer, and I gave it to him, and it was off the record, I'm glad to say. Harry?
Howard, if you're going to go off the record, we're going to have a lot of trouble through the evening. I think what Congressman Brademas said is very significant. That the big thing that we don't know, assuming we do know that in approximately 14 minutes, President Nixon is going to announce his resignation, what we don't know is what kind of an announcement will be, if it will be a divisive speech. In the past, when he has had to make an announcement after an agonizing experience like this, he has not been healing. Obviously, members of his own party and the Democrats hope he will be tonight. What's your guess?
Well, you know, in his book, The Six Crises, he says that when he is in a crisis, he behaves very well because he's keen, his nerves are keen, his mind is keen, but when the crisis, after the crisis, he loses control. And I don't know what stage of the crisis this is. He lost control in the Eisenhower crisis, where he sent in his resignation to Eisenhower from the ticket in 1952. Chotiner got the telegram and tore it up, prevented him leaving. He got angry with the press in 62, and against Herb Klein's advice, criticized the press and public there. I just don't know what stage of the crisis he feels he's in now.
He also said in his prefaces to the Six Crises that crisis by its nature is usually primarily personal, and whether an individual fails or succeeds in meeting and handling a crisis usually affects only his own future and possibly that of his family and his immediate circle of friends and associates. Not true this time. Now, about 12 minutes before we hear from President Richard Nixon, possibly for the last time as president, and we'll resume our anticipation right after this message. In roughly 11 or 12 minutes, President Nixon will address the nation. The anticipated import of his message will be the announcement of his resignation, and we will presumably have a 38th President of the United States tomorrow. ABC News is checking the mood of the country, and people who have particular knowledge of what's and sensitivity to what is happening tonight. We're also trying to get around to places like Dallas in Texas, which is as American a city as you can get. Out there is John North of WFAA-TV.
In Dallas tonight, there is very little frivolity. Most of the people here are quite somber. 1972, Dallasites gave Richard Nixon more than 70% of their vote, and nowhere could there be found more ardent supporters of Mr. Nixon, the man or his policies. But now local politicians and business leaders are publicly backing away from the president. An indication of that might be the Dallas Times-Herald, a conservative newspaper which in 1968-1972 backed the president editorially. And now, Monday, after the bombshell, the Dallas Times-Herald asked for the president's resignation. Local polls also indicate that the majority of the people here would like to see the president's resignation rather than impeachment or conviction. And there are mixed feelings among former pro-Nixon supporters. I talked to one man today who felt like the media had been acting as the hanging judge and that the president had no other choice now but to resign. I suppose the best way to sum it all up is that the majority of people here in Dallas now believe that the president has reached the end of his rope. And he does have, indeed, no other choice but resignation. From Dallas, this is John North for Channel 8 News. Now back to NBC News in New York.
Not quite NBC News, but now back to Howard K. Smith in Washington.
It had a B in the middle. Sam Donaldson's on Capitol Hill, and he's just had a talk with the Republican leader in the House of Representatives, John Rhodes of Arizona. Sam, what did he say?
Howard, Mr. Rhodes is back in his Hill office right behind us here, having gone down to the White House and seen the president, along with Mr. Nixon. Mr. Rhodes says he finds Mr. Nixon, word, says he's one of the gutsiest fellows he's ever known, that the president intends tonight to... the nation could not risk for the proceedings to run their course, both in the House and the Senate, and what's going to do in his office. To do any mea culpa, in other words, how he's done wrong. But at the same time, John Rhodes feels very strongly the president is a calming influence going to make a statesmanlike.
Thank you, Sam. We go back to the White House now, where Steve Bell has a report on things that are happening there. Steve?
Howard, throughout the evening, we have had large crowds gathered outside the White House here. As you probably can see behind us, we have a large number of people who have been standing by to watch the various television networks, some of them putting up signs about war resisters and amnesty, but most here out of curiosity and concern. Across the street, we've had something of a rally by those who still support President Nixon, with singing of hymns and speeches that have drawn both applause and boos. But most people I talked to earlier in the day, as they gathered to go through the White House as tourists, while they were split over whether Richard Nixon should or should not resign, were unified on one thing, and that was that the country could endure this crisis and come out even stronger. And I'm sure those people, as well as all of the rest of us, will be at television sets and radios tonight to hear what the president has to say.
Thank you, Steve. Steve told us just a while ago about ingoing presidents and outgoing presidents. It's a peculiar American habit that an outgoing president leaves nothing behind in any of the filing cases, unlike other countries in the world. A new president enters an empty White House. Harry?
Out in Los Angeles, it's still, I presume it's still light at 8 minutes of six. Judd Hambrick of KABC-TV is going to give us a report on how they feel out there tonight.
We're having quite a spirited discussion here on State Street. In fact, let me continue the discussion. What do you think is the importance of this?
Well, we were just talking about this, and this young man said that all the politicians are corrupt. It's a line I've heard quite often. I think it's a very dangerous line, and it's for this reason, because I think a lot of people agree with this line. All politicians are corrupt, Nixon is just one instance of it, etc. I think for this reason I was in favor of carrying out the full impeachment process. so that the full extent of the corruption of this administration would be brought to light.
There is a State Street in Los Angeles, but that is not State Street in Los Angeles. That is State Street in Chicago, and that was Joel Daly, not Judd Hemrick of KABC-TV. We will now come back very near to the time when President Nixon will address the nation, and we will resume our coverage after this pause for station identification.
This is ABC.
Well, in the 198 years of American national history under the Constitution, we have had a lot of different kinds of presidents and a lot of different things have happened to them. But presumably tonight, for the first time, we will hear a president resign his office. No one has ever done that before. Mr. Nixon speaks to the country in less than 5 minutes now. We've been sampling reaction and anticipation to this unprecedented announcement. I was surprised and disappointed, Howard, to hear various congressmen take the attitude toward the question of amnesty or toward the question of a sense of Congress resolution on amnesty, that it was not their business, that they didn't legally have the authority to do it. But I don't think that was what they were being asked to do at all. I think what they were being asked to do is the same kind of thing they've been asked to do in the last months, is to express in a representative way the sense of the country, not to impose their will on the courts or the special prosecutor. Do you have the feeling that they, having risen to the occasion in the House Judiciary Committee, they are now ducking again?
I think that that would be the forthright way to put it, yes. I think that so many of them want to avoid responsibility for any consequences of this and don't want to take a stand either way. I think you're perfectly right. Harry, it so happens it's against the rules for us to show President Nixon before his speech, but in fact he's taken his place at the table and he's chatting with some of the people around him. We can't see them, but he looks well. And he does look, as they say, serene. He doesn't appear nervous at all. He has a sheaf of papers in his hand. He has the presidential flag on one side of him, the American flag on the other. And he looks in good shape. If you can predict, he does not look divisive.
Well, one of the things that he said going back through his past history, another of the things he said in that famous book was that going through the necessary soul searching before a battle or before a crisis, trying to decide whether to fight it or run away from it, is far more difficult than the battle itself. You wondered what stage he was at. He may be at that stage of serenity that he claims he can reach.
That really is the impression one gets. He just sat down for a few moments in order to get the light, let the technicians get the light right. Then he waved at them and he took his sheaf of papers and he left the table where he will sit down and speak in just about 2 minutes' time.
There is an unavoidable poignancy about this, whatever your opinions of Mr. Nixon or your opinions about the wisdom of his decision to resign. The pure perquisites of the presidency are so dramatic and so soul-satisfying to almost any man, which is why so many people want to run for the presidency apart from their desire to serve the country. Everything he does today, if it is his last full day as president, must be very moving to him and to his family.
Indeed. Well, you know, the presidency is a very special office. I once asked an expert on World War I who had the most power, the Kaiser or the Tsar. He said the President of the United States has more power than either when he has to exercise it. When there's an emergency, he has far more power than any tyrant can have. And a president must use that power wisely and must know its limits. That's the great charm and the secrecy, I think, of running the office properly.
It's a very strange office. I suppose there's no question that it's the most powerful office in the world, even as opposed to, say, Mao Zedong or the leadership of Russia. And I think the battering that this presidency has taken in the last now 11 years is a stronger testimony to the strength of this country than anything else possibly could be. We survived assassination. We survived an extremely unpopular war. We then survived the driving out of office of Lyndon Johnson by a popular movement in 1968. And now, apparently, we have survived the worst scandal in the history of the presidency, depending to some extent on what the man who was in office during this scandal does in the next few minutes.
Yes, apparently, the men in Philadelphia who created the Constitution created something much stronger than any of its parts and much stronger than the sum of its parts. It has a spirit all its own, and I haven't seen it in my travels around the world anywhere else in the world, not in any of the free countries either. In just a moment now, the President of the United States will begin his speech, perhaps his last speech from the White House, and we'll see him in just a few moments. We have 40 seconds to go now. The President has taken his place at the table in the White House where he's going to speak. This is, everyone assumes, a speech in which he's going to state his reasons for changing his mind and possibly his reasons for resigning from the high office. There's the White House as it looks tonight. The rear entrance, the diplomatic entrance to the White House. And now, here now, the next picture will be the President of the United States.
Good evening. This is the 37th time I have spoken to you from this office, where so many decisions have been made that shaped the history of this nation. Each time I have done so to discuss with you some matter that I believe affected the national interest. In all the decisions I have made in my public life, I have always tried to do what was best for the nation. Throughout the long and difficult period of Watergate, I have felt it was my duty to persevere, to make every possible effort to complete the term of office to which you elected me. In the past few days, however, it has become evident to me that I no longer have a strong enough political base in the Congress to justify continuing that effort. As long as there was such a base, I felt strongly that it was necessary to see the constitutional process through to its conclusion, that to do otherwise would be unfaithful to the spirit of that deliberately difficult process and a dangerously destabilizing precedent for the future. But with the disappearance of that base, I now believe that the constitutional purpose has been served, and there is no longer a need for the process to be prolonged. I would have preferred to carry through to the finish, whatever the personal agony it would have involved. And my family unanimously urged me to do so. But the interests of the nation must always come before any personal considerations. From the discussions I have had with congressional and other leaders, I have concluded that because of the Watergate matter, I might not have the support of the Congress that I would consider necessary to back the very difficult decisions and carry out the duties of this office in the way the interests of the nation will require. I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first. America needs a full-time president and a full-time Congress, particularly at this time with problems we face at home and abroad. To continue to fight through the months ahead for my personal vindication would almost totally absorb the time and attention of both the President and the Congress in a period when our entire focus should be on the great issues of peace abroad and prosperity without inflation at home. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office. As I recall the high hopes for America with which we began this second term, I feel a great sadness that I will not be here in this office working on your behalf to achieve those hopes in the next 2.5 years. But in turning over direction of the government to Vice President Ford, I know as I told the nation when I nominated him for that office 10 months ago, that the leadership of America will be in good hands. In passing this office to the Vice President, I also do so with a profound sense of the weight of responsibility that will fall on his shoulders tomorrow, and therefore of the understanding, the patience, the cooperation he will need from all Americans. As he assumes that responsibility, he will deserve the help and the support of all of us. As we look to the future, the first essential is to begin healing the wounds of this nation, to put the bitterness and divisions of the recent past behind us, and to rediscover those shared ideals that lie at the heart of our strength and unity as a great and as a free people. By taking this action, I hope that I will have hastened the start of that process of healing which is so desperately needed in America. I regret deeply any injuries that may have been done in the course of the events that led to this decision. I would say only that if some of my judgments were wrong, and some were wrong, they were made in what I believed at the time to be the best interest of the nation. To those who have stood with me during these past difficult months, to my family, my friends, the many others who joined in supporting my cause because they believed it was right, I will be eternally grateful for your support. And to those who have not felt able to give me your support, let me say, I leave with no bitterness toward those who have opposed me, because all of us in the final analysis have been concerned with the good of the country, however our judgments might differ. So let us all now join together in affirming that common commitment and in helping our new president succeed for the benefit of all Americans. I shall leave this office with regret at not completing my term, but with gratitude for the privilege of serving as your president for the past 5.5 years. These years have been a momentous time in the history of our nation and the world. They have been a time of achievement in which we can all be proud. Achievements that represent the shared efforts of the administration, the Congress, and the people. But the challenges ahead are equally great, and they too will require the support and the efforts of the Congress and the people working in cooperation with the new administration. We have ended America's longest war, but in the work of securing a lasting peace in the world, the goals ahead are even more far-reaching and more difficult. We must complete a structure of peace so that it will be said of this generation, our generation of Americans, by the people of all nations, not only that we ended one war, but that we prevented future wars. We have unlocked the doors that for a quarter of a century stood between the United States and the People's Republic of China. We must now ensure that the one quarter of the world's people who live in the People's Republic of China will be and remain not our enemies, but our friends. In the Middle East, 100 million people in the Arab countries, many of whom have considered us their enemy for nearly 20 years, now look on us as their friends. We must continue to build on that friendship so that peace can settle at last over the Middle East, and so that the cradle of civilization will not become its grave. Together with the Soviet Union, we have made the crucial breakthroughs that have begun the process of limiting nuclear arms. But we must set as our goal not just limiting, but reducing and finally destroying these terrible weapons so that they cannot destroy civilization, and so that the threat of nuclear war will no longer hang over the world and the people. We have opened a new relation with the Soviet Union. We must continue to develop and expand that new relationship so that the two strongest nations of the world will live together in cooperation rather than confrontation. Around the world, in Asia, in Africa, in Latin America, in the Middle East, there are millions of people who live in terrible poverty, even starvation. We must keep as our goal turning away from production for war and expanding production for peace, so the people everywhere on this earth can at last look forward in their children's time, if not in our own time, to having the necessities for a decent life. Here in America, we are fortunate that most of our people have not only the blessings of liberty, but also the means to live full and good, and by the world's standards, even abundant lives. We must press on, however, toward a goal not only of more and better jobs, but of full opportunity for every American. And of what we are striving so hard right now to achieve, prosperity without inflation. For more than a quarter of a century of public life, I have shared in the turbulent history of this era. I have fought for what I believed in. I have tried, to the best of my ability, to discharge those duties and meet those responsibilities that were entrusted to me. Sometimes I have succeeded, and sometimes I have failed. But always, I have taken heart from what Theodore Roosevelt once said about the man in the arena